You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras. I'm Matthew Leach, talking National League East with MLB.com's five NL East beat reporters. Taking a look at David Wright's recovery, looking at Wilmer Flores, and talking Noah Syndergaard when we talk New York Mets. Be going into a lot of depth on Shelby Miller and looking at Williams Perez when we talk Atlanta Braves. The Marlins will be talking about the whole Dan Jennings and Mike Redmond situation. The Nationals will be talking about some injured players, Doug Fister, Jason Wirth, Casey Jansen, where they're at and how soon they'll be back and what the team does in the interim. With the Phillies, we'll be looking at some 30-somethings who are showing signs of life or more, talking Aaron Harang, Ryan Howard, and Chase Utley. Sounds like we finally got something resembling good news and progress on David Wright. Still not where he wants to be, but what's the latest on Wright's rehab?
Well, he's started baseball activities, which means he's doing something, and something is better than nothing, I guess. At this point, it's almost the phrase I would use would be damage control with him, because he's missed so much time already. He's missed so much more time than we originally thought he would. When he first got hurt and he first strained his hamstring, we were looking at 2 weeks, probably three, but certainly no longer than that, as long as it followed a normal progression. And now here we stand, and it's been, I believe, 5 weeks since he first got hurt. It might even be a little longer than that. And we're essentially looking at another two-month absence from a guy who's missed 2 months, it seems, every year for the past 4 years. There was one healthy season mixed in there. So in that sense, it's kind of damage control. They just want him back as soon as possible, and obviously they want him back healthy and 100% and ready to play the final, essentially, 4 months of the season without having to go down again. But it's really taken a long time, and given how long the injury has taken, well, this recovery is going to take a little longer now, because he's going to need to play in rehab games. He's going to need to get everything up to speed before he gets into rehab games, and so on and so forth. So it's been a long road. It's still got a ways to go, but he is making progress, and there's some tangible improvement from where we were at a week ago.
Meanwhile, the guy who, in a sense, was kind of brought up to take his spot, I realize not exactly that, but Dilson Herrera goes down, and he'd kind of been the guy that they found an opportunity for in the absence of Wright. He's now out. Do they sort of go back to what they were doing at first, which is Murphy back to second and Campbell at third, or is there some other option that they have to consider, given that they didn't really like the way that was going?
Yeah, no, that's exactly what they're going to do. What they have been doing since Dilson got hurt. You know, the one opportunity this sort of brought about is they could have done a little finagling, and they could have brought up Matt Reynolds to play shortstop and moved Wilmer Flores either to second base or to third base, thus ending an experiment that's gone, not so great so far. They decided not to do that. They still have confidence in Wilmer Flores at shortstop despite the errors. So they're basically taking the path more traveled, the route of least resistance right now, and using Eric Campbell at third base. Obviously, that's not a long-term solution, but the Mets are hoping this isn't a long-term thing. They're hoping David Wright comes back within the next couple of weeks, and they can end all this. But, they did have an opportunity to shake things up, and they declined it, and I think that's partially due to not wanting to really shake up Wilmer Flores' confidence any more than it already has, and I think it's partially due to an acknowledgement that David Wright will hopefully, from the Mets' perspective, be back sooner rather than later.
What are you seeing at the plate from Flores? I mean, it seems like his defense kind of is going to be what it is. And he's contributed some. Are they pleased with what he's shown offensively, or do they expect more now? Or he's been fine, but not special at the plate.
I think they're pretty reasonably pleased with what they've seen. The average leaves a little bit to be desired, but the power is certainly there. And, you know, when you're judging a shortstop like him, especially a young shortstop who still has room to grow, you have to look at it also from the perspective of the other shortstops around baseball. It's not a position that produces a lot of power hitters. It's not a position that produces a lot of good hitters in general. So if Wilmer Flores can go with even a halfway decent batting average and finish this year in the 15 to 20 homer range, which he's well on pace to do, all of a sudden you're looking at one of the better offensive shortstops in the league, and that heals a lot of wounds. You can put up with a lot more on the defensive side if he's doing that. Obviously, they would want the batting average to be higher, and I think the batting average will go a little higher. You're not talking about a 300 hitter here, but you know, you could reasonably expect him to bat in that 270, 275, maybe even 280 range once he hits his prime. And if he's doing that with power numbers, there's not a lot of shortstops in the league that do that. This is a big reason why the Mets have not and do not plan to pursue Troy Tulowitzki, because Troy Tulowitzki is a lot older, makes a lot more money, and the Mets feel that when you look down at the end of the year, maybe not this year, but maybe two or three years down the road, when you look at that shortstop production, well, no one expects Wilmer Flores to be at that level. They think he could be some reasonable facsimile of it, where it's just not worth going out and spending all the money and all the players and everything else on a guy who's you know, an offensive shortstop as well.
Another injury update, if you would. Where do things stand with Travis d'Arnaud? Is that a more encouraging situation?
It's definitely more encouraging than David Wright, only because we have a little more information on it. When Travis d'Arnaud first went down, we were looking at a 6 to 8 week timetable, and he's basically progressed right along schedule, unlike what David Wright has done. So you're still looking at essentially a June return. He could even maybe encourage the Mets a little more than that and come back late May. It's hard to tell. You know, he'd have to get into games, and we'll see how he progresses from there. But in terms of the healing process, which is 90% of the battle, he's right on schedule. So from there, it's just going to be a matter of getting those reps and getting those at-bats, getting back into baseball shape. And, you know, he should be back before too long.
Mets made what appears to be a minor free agent signing a Cuban free agent catcher. Is that in any way connected to the major league roster? Is this a guy who might provide depth, might save them from playing Johnny Monell, or is this just purely minor league depth?
No, that's minor league depth. You know, if there's one position the Mets are pretty rich right now, it is catching, with Travis d'Arnaud, Kevin Plawecki, Johnny Monell, certainly a bat-first catcher, but they have him on the roster right now as sort of their primary left-handed pinch hitter. So, you know, that signing is an older Cuban prospect. It's not one of those, you know, hotshot youngsters that everyone wants the Mets to go out and sign and is hoping the Mets will get in the market for some of those players. But that signing is just organizational depth at a position where the Mets are already actually pretty strong.
Well, if we're not going to talk about hotshot Cubans, let's talk about hotshot U.S. drafted players. I actually started to say American, but I wasn't. Yes, Noah Syndergaard was born in the U.S. I didn't want to say something stupid and find out he was drafted in born in Canada. Anyway, another really good start, probably maybe more impressive than the first one. Were his struggles last year just a matter of Las Vegas, getting his head in the right place? I mean, the difference between his performance even last year in AAA and his performance in the big league so far is really striking.
Well, first on your geography, Texas is a very long way from Canada, so I just want to make that clear. In terms of Noah Syndergaard's struggles last year, you know, it's hard to get into a guy's head and to project things, but I think a lot of it was mental for him. I think a lot of it was a guy just straight up learning how to pitch. You know, it's sort of the classic story of the guy who's always thrown harder than everyone else and could get by on that high fastball out of the zone, striking guys out with that, and can just beat guys with that fastball at the lower levels. And never really had to learn or develop his other pitches or really rely on them. If you watched Noah Syndergaard's debut in Chicago, I thought it was really telling. He was throwing a lot of breaking pitches early in counts. He was throwing a lot of curveballs in fastball counts, things like that. Things that, from all the reports, he wasn't really doing with regularity last year. So I think it's a lot of that, and it's a lot of him just learning to be a pitcher, where he was more of a thrower before. And it seems simple. Some guys take longer than others to figure it out. But as we said when he got called up, the stuff is clearly major league caliber. It's clearly elite major league caliber. So if he can continue down that path and learn to be a pitcher and learn how to keep hitters off balance, when to change speeds, how to, you know, guide that fastball to different quadrants of the strike zone as opposed to just pumping it in as hard as he can, I don't think there's any question he can be successful at this level.
what is it fair and reasonable to expect of him this year? The long term is very exciting. Is this a guy who can be a 2-3 on a contending team this year?
I don't see why not. I mean, you know, if you look at pitchers of that pedigree, of that caliber, like I said, the stuff is there. It's ace caliber stuff. He has an ace ceiling. And it's a matter of putting it all together and figuring that out. Now, of course, the Mets are going to limit him in some fashion, and you know, they're not going to just let him go out there and you know, throw 200 innings. But you know, if he can stay in the rotation all year, which it looks like right now, it's a pretty good bet that he'll be able to, at least for now. There's no reason why he can't be a 2-3. Yeah, maybe he'll walk a few more guys than you'd like. Maybe he'll give up a few more hits than you like. He'll leave some pitches over the zone that he might not a year or two from now, and that's what will separate him from being that middle-of-the-rotation guy or an inconsistent guy versus what the Mets feel he can ultimately become. But if you're going to bet on a young pitcher, you're going to bet on one with stuff, and his stuff is really off the charts. You know, coming up, better reviews of that stuff than we saw from Matt Harvey coming up, just as good as we saw from Zach Wheeler coming up. And again, I'm not comparing these pitches, I'm not saying Noah Syndergaard is going to be as good as Matt Harvey, only that from a sheer physical standpoint, he has the potential to be. So it's hard to bet against the guy to say, I'm not sure he's going to have success when you have those physical tools.
Mark, the Braves obviously liked Shelby Miller. He was a guy that they targeted in a deal with the Cardinals. He kind of fits their profile in some ways. He's an athletic guy. He's got a big arm. So it shouldn't be a surprise to anybody that he's pitching well. But he's a guy who, when he was drafted, I think people thought maybe had number one upside, at least strong two upside. And then that kind of diminished a little bit. Did they think they were getting a guy who still had that kind of upside in him, or are they at all surprised by how well things are going right now?
I think they certainly knew his potential was to elevate to ace-type status, a strong, you know, top-of-the-rotation guy. And I think I have to credit John Hart with the way a couple of times he did this winter when he acquired players, and he didn't put a lot of pressure on them immediately and come out and directly say exactly what his ultimate expectations of the guy were. And the case in point with Shelby, he just continues to say, hey, look, he has the potential to be a top-of-the-rotation guy. Kind of described him more as, hey, you know, he's entering the season as a number two, number three type guy. You know, the way he finished the season last year, he showed the potential to continue to make progress. And what we've seen here through these first eight starts of the season is a guy who has finally lived up to all those expectations that were present when the Cardinals drafted him, a guy who has transformed himself by adding the sinker and the cutter to his repertoire. And it just that those two additional looks have provided him so much success here, dating back to when he added the sinker to his repertoire. I think that was August 23rd last year in Philadelphia.
There's been a lot of talk about the sinker, and it's a sort of it's not an uncommon thing, especially a young guy throws hard, throws a four-seamer, and learns that maybe being able to throw down in the zone against big league hitters is a good thing. I feel like there's been less attention given to the cutter, but he's added that and throwing it a lot as well. How does he use the cutter as part of what he does these days?
You know, I really see the cutter as just that different look of, you know, here he is, he's throwing 93 mile per hour, or, you know, 94 mile per hour pretty much consistently, four-seamer. He throws the sinker that's registering probably right around 93.5 miles per hour on average. Now all of a sudden he throws the cutter in at 86, 87. Just provides a little bit of a different look to him. And like you said, he's getting some ground balls with that and jamming some guys. He's still relying, you know, heavily. I think through the last start, he was basically 34% four-seam fastball, 33% two-seamer. He's continuing to throw the curveball. The cutter just adds that extra look. He basically has three fastballs now. And like I said, the two are so powerful. You're seeing a guy who's throwing 93, 94 consistently onto with two fastballs that move in different directions. And at the same time, he also has that ability to really ramp up and throw the four-seamer like he did to Stanton on Sunday. He threw him, he had a three-pitch strikeout where he was 97, 97, 97. He painted the corners on the first two pitches. He looked at him and swung through one that he elevated up in the zone with the third pitch there. So it's impressive stuff.
So is the cutter more like a fastball with a little bit of hook on it, or is it more like a small slider? Is he one of those guys that can kind of throw both?
You know what? I really think it may develop into more of the slider. I think you're I can't say that he's definitely trying to evolve it into that, but I think that it has more of that type of action for him right now. And so all of a sudden you've got four-seamer, boom, sinking, and now you've got the cutter where you know, you've got something coming at you with it at a little bit of an angle here instead of it. You've got the downward angle, you've got the straight in, and you've got the – it's not quite the slider look, but I'd say that it has more of that look to it than the hook.
And then the other part of this, and you did mention this, is the dude's just throwing strikes. I mean, and it's interesting because coming up through the minors, he was a strike thrower, and then his first couple years in the majors, he walked too many guys. Is that a matter of approach? Is he sort of just more confident, more aggressive with his stuff? Is it what goes into a guy kind of refining that strike throwing ability?
I'm guessing that it has to do with that confidence element that you touched on there. Last year he threw 60.6% of his first pitch strikes and 60% of the batters he faced. Now he's closer to 65.5%. He's getting ahead. That's allowing him to use his other stuff a little bit. You know, I guess increasing the value of his additional pitches. You know, he's not a guy who's going to go out there and strike out 10-plus guys, you know, a game. He's been getting ground balls consistently. I think probably when you knew him probably early on, you saw him more as a guy, a lot of high fly ball percentage. He's with the sinker, he's getting ground balls. That leads to quicker innings, and it's allowing him to go deeper into games and just be that much more efficient.
Miller is just one part of what is suddenly a very young Braves rotation. And we've talked about Mike Foltynewicz. I know absolutely nothing about Williams Perez, except that he has a name that reminds me of Formula One. And he's young, and he's out of the system. What made this guy the choice, and what does he offer?
Yeah, you know, he landed on the radar last year when he had success in Double-A Mississippi's rotation. He gets added to the 40-man roster midway through spring training, maybe 2 weeks into the Grapefruit League season. His stats aren't impressive, but I keep hearing, you know, hey, you know, watch out for him this year. And he goes to Gwinnett, has some success, shows up last night, and he got out of a couple jams. Showed an effective changeup and curveball to go along with his two-seamer. He relies heavily on that two-seamer. That's his pitch. But to see the swings and misses that he got with the changeup and curveball, you can see why the Braves are high on him in that starter's role, where he's able to you know, use those pitches much more frequently than he did. We saw him earlier this month. He comes up and makes two relief appearances, and he retired just six of the 14 batters he faced. I think that was just he wasn't used to the relief role. It didn't suit him best for his stuff. I don't know who Williams Perez or what Williams Perez is going to do here the next few outings. I even question whether he would be an upgrade over Eric Stoltz. But what I will say is this: it makes perfect sense to keep sending Williams Perez out there the next few weeks. And then all of a sudden you say, okay, if he's not working, then it's time to maybe bring up Matt Whistler or Manny Bamuelos. But what we're looking at is the Braves have at least seven legitimate candidates for a starting rotation next year, with Miller, Teron, Wood, Foltynewicz, Bamuelos, Whistler, Perez. And then you've got Terrell Jenkins on the periphery. Maybe he's not ready at the start of next year. They have a definite need for a left fielder. Let me change that, a power-hitting outfielder. I do expect them to trade one of these pitchers at some point, whether that's in July or this winter, to start filling some of their needs. So they need to find out exactly what they have in some of these guys. And instead of continuing to throw Eric Stoltz out there once every 5 days, you know, go ahead and examine what you have in these guys and figure out who it is you want to keep.
How do they kind of cycle through that as the year goes on? Because this team is still kind of on the fringe of contention. There's still not necessarily signs that Washington's going to run away with it. And yet, it's interesting because suddenly this team really is kind of, I think, what a lot of us wanted to see. We wanted to see them. If they're going to do this, then do it. If you're going to get young and look at what you got, then do it. And it seems like they're kind of closer to that now with the team they're putting out there. How do they sort of cycle through these guys, figure out what they've got, evaluate all these different candidates, while still maintaining a desire to stay at least somewhat in the hunt?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I was talking to John Harden, it wasn't just earlier this week. He's mentioned it many times. Hey, look, we want to compete this year, but at the same time, we want to, you know, we know that this is the time to figure out what we have for the future. I've heard somebody else say, we have one eye on 2015 and two eyes on 2016 and 17. Yes, they want to remain competitive this year. They're not going to just go ahead and use this as a testing ground all year long with you know, hey, look, let's bring this guy up here when it doesn't make sense. You know, in other words, they're not going to rush Matt Whistler up here just to get him up here. He's going to have to earn that spot. You see it with Jose Peraza. They're going to continue to be patient with him. There really hasn't been any need to bring Peraza up yet. But it is a fine line that they're walking where they're saying, hey, look, we understand that maybe, even if you can't catch the Nationals, maybe you can sneak in and be a wild card team. But at the same time, they are having to look at what they have for the future, especially in this rotation. And if you take a step back and say, you know, really how much different would Williams Perez or Whistler or Banuelos be than Eric Stoltz? It's probably, you know, maybe all of them would be better, maybe just equal. This is just the time to find out. The one guy that's really interesting there is Banuelos because he has pitched so effectively at Gwinnett, but because he only threw 76 innings last year coming back from Tommy John surgery, he's basically got 80 innings to play with the rest of this year. And, you know, if you break that down, 14 to 15 more starts. So it'll be interesting to see how they bring him up because there's obviously a need for some help in the bullpen, but you want to continue to develop him as a starter because that's what you're looking for him to be in the future. So I'm interested to see exactly how they play with. I don't think they've made a decision exactly how they're going to do that. You know, do you bring him up here to make a few starts and then he ends the season, then your bullpen helping you out? It's a factor as a reliever down the stretch. Do you, you know, skip a few starts with Gwinnett so that he is available as a potential starter down the stretch for you? You know, the one thing I will say about this team is people say, well, where do you think this is heading? I said, look, you know, I don't know exactly how successful they're going to be, whether they're going to be a 500 team, whether they're going to creep above that 500 mark and be a wild card team. But this is chapter one in what is shaping up to be a very interesting story. You're going to want to read the rest of this book if you're, you know, or you're going to want to follow the remainder of the story. So my suggestion is to go ahead and keep up tabs here with the beginning of the story because, you know, it is very interesting where this team is heading. I do see a lot of promise for the future. And, you know, I have been interested in how many fans have continued to say, hey, look, this team is so much more enjoyable to watch than the last few teams because I think there is some excitement, not only because they're you know, exceeding some expectations this year, but people see where they're heading, and they're excited about what the future holds for this team.
Bill, I had a few questions prepared, and we're still going to get to them, but last night changed a little bit what we need to talk about. It was a really weird scene with Bryce Harper, Matt Williams, and Marvin Hudson last night, and there are a whole lot of different angles to it. But it seems like, despite the fact that Harper does have some reputation in some quarters as not the most even-keeled guy, it does not seem like he was particularly out of line last night. How did you see that kind of strange sequence that ended up with Harper and Williams being ejected?
I didn't think he did anything wrong. It was obvious that the Marvin Hudson had an argument with Matt Williams. It seems like Marvin Hudson wasn't paying attention to Harper at all. And then all of a sudden, his Marvin Hudson telling Harper to get back in the box. So it was strange. I didn't think he deserved to be ejected like that. And, obviously Harper's going to get fined for it, but, he didn't deserve to be out of that game, to be honest.
Is Hudson a guy that either he or the Nationals in general have had issues with before?
I tell you, I don't recall that, although I heard that Hudson once ejected Harper after the game ended. I mean, to me, I don't count that as an ejection. Game's over. So, if there was a problem, that'd be too bad, because it's kind of really silly to be arguing with a manager and then ejecting his player. So I just don't understand why it happened yesterday.
The previous time, Matt Williams, he certainly didn't jump all over Bryce Harper, but also there was some degree of that really can't happen. And understandably, that was a key moment in the game, and it was particularly costly. It seemed like this time there wasn't any of that, that from the club's perspective, they did not even view this as really a teaching moment for Harper. Is that correct?
That's correct. It was a teaching moment. The other time in Arizona, that was a teaching moment. Harper, Harper didn't swing, but he shouldn't have argued with the umpire in Arizona. And that ejection was deserved. So, this is a different story totally.
Is there any worry, because Harper's such an interesting guy, because he does kind of draw attention. He's a fiery guy. He can be a demonstrative guy, but he's also not a guy in general he's not one of those guys who carps over every called strike. So it's kind of an interesting mix where I think among some fans there's a reputation, but I'm not sure he's done anything to really earn it, particularly with umpires. And what I'm getting at here, is there any worry on the Nationals' part, not even that Harper is in any way out of line, but is there any worry that he might become a guy that umpires kind of have an extra eye on?
No, I don't. I mean, everyone knows how good this guy is. I mean, to me, Harper's, when he gets mad, it's once in a blue moon. I mean, it's not like this is often. We're not dealing with Albert Bell here. So I don't see Harper going out of line. I mean, this guy really loves the game. You can tell the guy acts like a kid sometimes when he plays the game of baseball. I mean, he is the least of this team's worry. I mean, I think right now they're worried. Their number one worry is their injuries, and that's the bottom line. I mean, Harper's not even on the list of concerns.
And because you are a veteran and professional, you set me up perfectly for the next direction here, which is those injuries. And first of all, how long are they going to be without Doug Fister?
Well, Matt Williams said that it's not going to be long. It's going to be maybe a few starts. But then again, with the Nationals, we've heard this before. And, they ended up being out a month, 2 months. So I'm expecting Fister to be out a while. He has a forearm strain, and we haven't seen him really since the day he was hit hard against the Padres. So we'll see how it goes. Hopefully we'll see him before this homestand ends, and we'll just take it from there.
Is there any worry that this is more than that? Forearm is one of those words that sometimes kind of leads to other scary words, or are they convinced that it really is just that?
Well, Matthew, ever since I've known you, I've always told you I have to take a wait-and-see approach, because every time with the Nationals we hear he's going to be out a few days,
the person's out a month. And, you know, like we heard that with Anthony Rendon, for example, when he hurt his knee originally, he was going to be out a few days. So, you know, we were told the forearm strain with Pfister, it was not serious. But, again, I got to take a wait-and-see approach to see how long he's going to be out for.
Is that A.J. Cole's spot for as long as Pfister is out, or is that something where they look at other options there?
Well, obviously, they have a few days off, so they're going with a four-man right now. But, yes, when it comes to that fifth spot, A.J. Cole is the guy. Right now, he's a long reliever. He did a good job against the Padres, and I'm expecting Cole to be that guy.
Is that an indicator that, at least for this year, that ship has sailed for Tanner Roark? He's in relief for the remainder of this year, almost no matter what?
Yes, that ship has sailed, yes. He's done a great job, you know, in the role he's been doing, which is long relief, middle relief, and the back end of that bullpen. He's done a great job. He basically took Stanton's role. And what I respect about Tanner Roark is that he has moped. He enjoys what he's doing. And he's happy to have a job.
All right. And the other really noteworthy injury here recently is Jason Wirth is back on the DL. He's such an important part of this offense as a guy who hits near the top of the lineup and gets on base. How long are they going to be doing without him?
I think it's going to be a while. I mean, yeah, they didn't find any ligament damage, no fractures or anything like that. But Wirth thinks it's going to be a while because, you know, the guy's in pain. And the swelling has to go away. So it's going to take a while. I think he'll be out at least a month. And you know, we'll see what happens. I don't think this is a couple weeks type of thing or 15 days. It's going to be a while.
And is that, again, Michael Taylor clearly stepping into those at-bats?
It's going to be between Michael Taylor and Tyler Moore. And that's it's going to be interesting. I mean, Tyler Moore has been really comfortable at the plate lately. He hit a home run yesterday, as you saw. But, yeah, it's going to be those two guys, and I don't see them making a move just to replace Jason Wirth right now.
The guy they brought up, Wilmer Defoe, is kind of an interesting guy. He hasn't done a lot in the high minors. He was off to a real nice start this year. What does he bring?
The guy can hit. This is not a one-year thing. I mean, this guy started last year, drove in 90 runs, was their player of the year last year. And he's going to replace either Ian Desmond at short or Danny Espinosa at second. He's going to be the everyday guy by next year. And that guy can really hit. The guy brings excitement to the game. He can really run. Had a great spring training. But we'll see what happens, how long he stays. He replaced Jason Wirth on the roster. And we'll see what happens.
He's a guy now, he's obviously quite young, but he's a guy who didn't really hit a lot really before last year. Had a couple of nice years, had a decent year in rookie ball. But what kind of came on for him and has turned him from a guy who didn't really hit a lot to, as you note, for the last year plus, a guy who really has been a hitter?
He really worked out. I mean, he really dedicated himself during the offseason, two seasons before that. And drove in 90 runs, and he did the same thing this past the off season. And I'm telling you, he's legit. I think he's legit. He can really hit. He can really play defense. He can play second and short, although he says he prefers to play short. But I think he's willing to do anything for the team right now.
And then one more thing, Casey Jansen sounds like he is close but not quite there. What's his status?
Well, he's going to have two more. He's going to pitch two more games. Hopefully, after that, he'll rejoin the team in Chicago. Now, he'll be in the back end of the bullpen by the time he gets back. Right now, the philosophy is not there. But with him, he's never been a guy who, you know, threw 90, 95 miles an hour anyway. So I don't think they're concerned about that. I think he'll be ready by the time they go to Chicago.
I have to warn you all that Joe has not been prepped on what we're going to talk about this week, so it could be absolutely anything. We could hit any kind of random topic. Oh, wait, no. Okay. First, Joe, the Marlins committed to Mike Redmond for an extension not that long ago. They are a little bit, but not a lot, under 500, and a little bit, but not a lot, out of first place, despite doing without their top two starting pitchers. So it's hardly fair to evaluate how good this club is right now. And yet, somehow after 38 games, they decided that Mike Redmond was no longer the guy. So first, simple question, why is that?
It is one of the strangest stories, Matthew, in over 10 years of covering this team, and there have been plenty of strange stories.
That's saying a lot.
Just to get to this point, because it just kind of became internal disarray, and you know, now they're trying to hold it together with, you know, the blown saves on the road trip seem to have cost Mike Redmond his job. You know, obviously they go to Washington, San Fran, and L.A., go 4-6 in those three places, which isn't dreadful considering the quality of competition, but had three blown saves, one in the eighth inning by Brian Morris, and then the ones in San Francisco and Los Angeles by Steve Cishek, which cost him his closer's job, and ultimately kind of set the mood in, you know, the front office to or upper management, I should say, or ownership, to just basically say they don't like the direction. And then, and you know, they came home, they were flat against the Braves, almost got no hit on Sunday, and by Shelby Miller, and that was the last straw. And the twist is obviously the guy they hired, you know, the general manager, Dan Jennings, with no previous coaching or managing experience at the professional level. And it's just kind of startling and stunning as this team is trying to find its stride. You know, they're trying to grind through a rough patch, which all teams are going to do. And next thing they know, they got a new voice and a new direction. And, you know, they're going to see if they could kind of regroup internally.
I have read the quotes. I know what the official answer is as to why Dan Jennings was the choice. Great baseball guy, knows these guys, etc. With that said, I suspect there are a large number of guys within the organization about whom that same thing could be said. Minor league managers, coaches, there are plenty of people who are likable, energetic baseball guys who know the players on this roster. So, given that those same descriptors probably apply to plenty of other people, why was Jennings the choice and not, if they're going to stay with him, if they're not going to go with a search, if they're not going to go find somebody outside the organization, they're not going to commit to their next manager. If this is presumably for the rest of this year and then they figure it out after that, why is it Dan Jennings and not any of a number of other options?
I think, Matthew, that they wanted to try to keep as much continuity and stability. They didn't feel they were far off. You know, I think they didn't want to completely rattle the cage and bring in an outside voice, someone from another team, or, you know, a former manager who may have his own style, his own way of doing things. They kind of wanted a, yeah, they obviously used the word wanted a different voice. I don't think they wanted a completely radical voice. So then they wanted to kind of hold it together as best they can, and all the qualities that Dan Jennings possesses are what they kind of look for, except for he has zero dugout experience. But I tell you, Matt, it makes no sense. Let's make that clear. This is completely crazy, and it's so far out of the box and not very rational. But what I've noticed being around the team, the players aren't that disturbed by it. Even though, you know, it's also weird because Redmond didn't lose the clubhouse. But so many people like Dan Jennings, and all these players like Dan Jennings, that they're willing to give him a chance, which is the biggest key in all of this, Matthew, because it doesn't really matter what anyone else really thinks as long as they buy in. So this is what's going to be completely fascinating about this is, yes, the idea of, and I think we're seeing the sport moving more where the front office has to be in step with the dugout in terms of how do we even want to, you know, set the lineup? Do we want this guy up or that guy up? And yes, I could see more teams following a similar path, but Dan Jennings is a baseball guy's baseball guy. He's a scout who likes to be near the field. He's not so much your, you know, just break down the numbers and this is why this guy should be playing. So they could possibly pull this off because of only the man that's there, this guy who's that charismatic and has that many people like him, buy into him.
is this just, presumably they at least hope it is for the remainder of this year. Is it just the remainder of this year and then they revisit this winter, or is there some possibility that this is beyond that?
Yeah, let's handle the first part. If it's not the remainder of this year, it means it's a complete disaster, and he feels he's so overmatched and not being fair to this clubhouse that he basically says, let me go back and be the GM and let's, you know, slide someone else in there. So if it's not for the rest of this year, that means this year is a complete disaster. They say he Dan is signed through 18, you know, just like Mike Hill, the president of baseball operations. I just don't see it in 16. I have to think he goes back and they go the conventional way and just get the manager of their choice and they go that way, even if they win, even if they somehow turn this around the way they like and go farther than anyone can imagine. I still don't see Dan Jennings managing in 16. The only way, Matthew, I see that is if he basically, in his mind, becomes a manager. But if he's still in his mind the general manager, I think eventually it will create the same divides that happened many times with every other manager. The manager is always going to be the buffer to the front office and is always going to kind of take the bullets for the players. And if DJ thinks more like traditional baseball people that wear the uniform and in his mind is a manager, then I think he stays. But if not, I really would be surprised if he's a manager in 16.
We have so far, and I feel like most of the coverage in general has so far, concentrated on the clubhouse and the dugout, concentrated on Jennings as manager and his relation to the club on the field. To me, there's another really big component of this, which is that this is a club with needs, and it's a club that views itself as a contender, which means that
right.
The next 2.5 months are pretty important for the front office. You know, they could probably use some innings somehow in their rotation. They could probably use some help in their bullpen. This is not a perfect team. It's a team that can use upgrades. It's a team that has identified 2015 as a season it intends to win, which means that it needs a front office to be busy. So how does the front office work? How does that work with its general manager removed as these next 2.5 months go by, and even beyond
that? That is a really fantastic point. And it also impacts the draft, Matthew, because DJ is very much involved running out and looking at players. But let's take to the big league level. You know, Hill and Jennings kind of worked in tandem anyway. So it's not like, and Michael is a GM himself being promoted to the president of baseball ops. So, you know, he's over that. They feel they have a very good support staff with assistant GM Mike Berger, Jeff McAvoy, and Craig Weissman. And these guys have been, you know, they all came in when they replaced Larry Beinfest. Those other guys came in to kind of join how they do things. So things will run pretty much as usual on that front, but DJ's influence in personnel, in the scouting and directing, and just, you know, being a guy who could kind of keep things together will definitely be missed on that front, and it will, you know, impact that. But I think right now, Matthew, they know they may need a trade. Obviously, the bullpen's been the biggest disaster. That's what's going on now. I mean, there's been some spotty starting pitching. Yeah, we get that part. But Jose's coming back. Alvarez should get better with a few more starts. So their two, you know, best two starters will be there. The other guys have been serviceable. But this team's going to be a better team when Tom Kohler is pitching the eighth inning. And I think they're just kind of waiting. But Kohler's been, you know, such a bulldog. You know, he does what he needs to do as a starter as well. But his role, they really need him in the eighth inning to shore that up. And they're going to need, whether it's Justin Nicolino, or Jose Urena, or Kendry Flores, who's in Double-A, the other two guys are in Triple-A, they're going to need one of those three to probably come up at some point in the next couple of weeks, solidify the rotation, so some of the starters could go into the bullpen and help patch that up. And then if they could get to the magic number is, Matthew, in terms of where they are, in terms of if they feel they got any shot this year, the closer they are, if they're at 500 at the All-Star break, that's the deadline they're looking at. They're not looking at where they are now. They know it's going to take a few weeks to sort this out. But if they could get into that position, then you could start seeing trades, and then they could kind of be like the rest of the pack.
Todd, I have my first note written down on my little sheet of questions here reads exactly as follows. Aaron Harang, I mean, what? And that's really my question for you. This guy is 37, is a right-hander who doesn't throw hard, and he's really good. What's going on here?
You know, I actually asked him pretty much the same question, not in his last start this week in Colorado, but last weekend in Philadelphia. I said, you're 37 years old. How are you doing this? And he kind of looked, befuddled at the question. I said, I mean, it looks like you can pitch another 5 years at this rate. He said, whoa, let's slow down here. Let's just worry about what's happening right now. But he has been really, really impressive, obviously. And he basically said, he's 37. Yeah, I don't throw very hard, but I really kind of know myself. I kind of know how to handle certain situations. He's like, I have good perspective on, if I give up a hit or something bad happens behind me, I don't kind of get frustrated and freak out and lose myself. Like, I kind of stay in the moment and I kind of go pitch by pitch. And he says, I really think that that's helping me right now. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. Roy Howell, they talked a lot about that. You know, if I give up a hit or if there's an error behind me, I just focus on the next pitch. Like, I don't sit there and go, oh boy, here we go. Things are going to start rolling downhill on me and I'm in deep trouble. And also obviously he's throwing pitches in the strike zone and he's using his off-speed pitch as well. But I really think just his overall experience has really helped him so far. And that could end up becoming a huge, huge signing for the Phillies when we talk about this rebuilding process, going forward.
I mean, he's a guy who the Braves, as far as I could tell, really made no real effort to keep him. And somewhat understandably, I mean, he had a really rough year in 2013. And so even though he bounced back, it was sort of understandable to think, you don't want to be the team that pays him for last year. But now that we're going on a year and a half now of him being a guy that apparently you believe in, is there probably some real trade value in this guy? I mean, he's not going to have a 1 ADRA at the deadline, but there's a pretty decent chance he'll be in the threes and an inning eater. Is this a guy that really might fetch them something at the deadline?
Yeah, I absolutely think so. And the Phillies have already started getting calls on him. And it's interesting because everybody would love to have Cole Hamels. There's no doubt about it. But do you want to pay the price to get Cole Hamels, which is going to be a long-term contract plus some top prospects? With Aaron Harang, you're going to have to give up a prospect or two, maybe not at the level of Cole Hamels. Plus, you're not locked into that long financial commitment. And he signed to a one-year, $5 million deal. And if he's traded at the end of July, you're talking about you only have to pay, less than, $2 million, less than $2 million, before 4 months of the season at that point. So a heck of a bargain, So I think he's going to be kind of that second tier guy that a contending team can get with really just tremendous, just tremendous value for a guy like that. And as you said, he's not going to have a 1.8 ERA in the middle of July or late June, most likely. But if he's in the mid threes and your contending team is going, ooh, Aaron Harang, this sounds like a pretty good deal for us. Let's maybe push for him rather than give up, three top prospects and commit tens of millions of dollars on Cole Hamels or somebody else that might be on the market.
He's kind of a fascinating story. I mean, he's a guy who I think a couple of different times looked like maybe he was done and then he'll bounce back and nobody believes it. How long does he – I mean, you mentioned he sort of dismissed 5 years, and understandably, but – for a guy who has for a long time looked like a year-to-year guy, how long does he want to keep doing this? Do you think this is a guy that's got another 2 or 3 years in him?
Well, yeah, he didn't he certainly could. If he pitches like this, he certainly could. And I think the fact that he's not a hard thrower, he's a guy that kind of can pitch in and out of the strike zone, kind of knows what he's doing, kind of knows his limitations. He seems to be a guy that definitely can do that. It's not like he's going to have to suddenly reinvent himself a year or two down the road. He already is kind of what he is. So, yeah, I think it's possible. And going back to kind of what you said earlier about the Braves, I think you know, he was looking for a 2-year deal at the time. So you understand the Braves' hesitation going, all right, we're rebuilding. Why are we going to commit to this guy for 2 years coming off that 2013? Boy, that could really come back to bite us. But, you know, 1-year deal on a guy like Harang turns out to be a really, really fantastic deal right now for the Phillies.
Speaking of guys in their 30s who aren't quite dead yet, Ryan Howard has been torrid for nearly this entire month. Is Howard just hot for a couple of weeks here? Is he maybe a little better than some of us skeptics thought coming into the year?
That is really tough to say. I think he's definitely better than what he showed the first couple weeks of the season. I mean, he was dreadful the first 2 weeks of the season. And there were so many people, fans tweeting at me and getting emails from people saying, you know, they should just release him, they got to bench him. And thankfully, the Phillies stuck with him for a little while. And to be honest, I said the same thing. I'm like, you got, as poorly as he's played so far, you've got to keep playing him for one reason. You're rebuilding. And you're trying to, you have nothing to lose right now by playing Howard. And if you can play Howard, and if he can somehow get hot, and if he can maintain that through June or early July, maybe you could actually flip him to a team, a contending team, and get a prospect back for him rather than just releasing the guy and getting nothing and having to eat the entire amount of that contract. So, is he going to be able to keep it up? It's hard to say. He was on a similar pace at this point last year and kind of faded down the stretch. But like I just said, you don't need him to play the entire season. You just need him to play this way through, you know, July 15th, July 31st, and maybe you can get somebody to bite and take him off your hands for the next season and a half. Now, the Phillies are still going to have to eat a ton of that contract, and I think they're more than happy to do it if they can get one prospect back for him. And can you imagine getting – one prospect back for Ryan Howard that might be able to help you down the road? I think the Phillies going into the season would say, if we can do that, boy, we'd be thrilled.
And that really is the question with Howard. Do you think he has played himself into that kind of position where maybe he is somewhat tradable, with the caveat that there will be financial considerations in whatever deal would happen?
I think so, yeah. You know, he entered the season with $60 million on his contract over 2 years. I think the Phillies were willing to eat, you know, $50 million. And now that he's played a little bit in the season, that money obviously has gone down a little bit. But I still think the Phillies are willing to eat that much money. Now, if you look back at his last month, from like April 21st through today, he's got the 19th best OPS in baseball of like 190 qualified hitters in that time. Only four players in baseball have hit more home runs than that in that time. And I'm not saying he's going to keep up that pace, but if he's a guy that, you know, come July is looking like a 30 home run, 90 to 100 RBI guy, and the Phillies are willing to eat most of that contract, I've got to think there's got to be a team out there that's going to go, Ryan Howard for less than $10 million over the next 2 years, you know, we need a big bat. Let's roll the dice and take a shot at him. I don't think you're going to get a blue-chip prospect for him, but, again, getting something for him is certainly better than nothing and just letting that contract run out or releasing him at some point.
And likewise, it seems like there are some signs of life here from Chase Utley. How is he closer? Is he looking a little more like himself to you?
He is, and, you know, now that we've talked about, you know, his season, and he's had some bad luck, but he also is hitting a lot of ground ball outs, and that indicates, you know, he's not driving the ball like he has in the past. But certainly over the last week, he has looked a lot better, and that kind of he kind of follows what's going on with Howard. You know, I've had a lot of people say, well, you know, should they bench him because he don't want to hit that 500 plate appearance mark, which should vest a club option next year at $15 million. And my whole thing is, just like Howard, you got to keep playing him and hope he gets hot, and then maybe you can trade him at some point. And certainly this last week is very encouraging. They're hoping that he kind of goes back to what he has been in the past. And, you know, the MLB.com StatCast information showed that, you know, his batted ball velocity is a little bit under league average, which says one thing. He's not as bad as he's been because he is hitting the ball at, you know, making decent enough contact where you expect those numbers to go up. So say Utley from last week through July 31st is hitting 270, you know, an OPS in the 800s or even in 750 or higher, you know, you might actually be able to trade him to a contending team that needs a second baseman. And that's what this is all about. It sounds kind of crazy to say, well, why does it make sense for a rebuilding team to play these two aging veterans every day? But it makes sense. You might be able to trade him to get some younger players. So I think the Phillies are hoping the same thing that's kind of going on with Howard is it continues with Chase Utley, too.
MLB.com Extras. Thanks, everybody, for listening.